Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Sam McGee, your guide. Today we're embarking on an exploration into the Register RSS Feeds Afternoon Edition for Wednesday, September 10th, 2025. Every week, the tech world throws, well, a deluge of information our way, and our mission here is to sift through that torrent, extract the most important nuggets of knowledge, and deliver them to you in a way that's not just informative, but genuinely engaging.
And I'm Taylor Littis, here to help connect those crucial dots, provide the broader context, and delve into the deeper implications of what's shaping our digital lives. We aim to move beyond just the headlines, helping you really grasp the forces at play.
And this deep dive is packed. We've got a substantial stack of articles from the Register covering everything from the evolving impact of AI on human skills and the, well, bewildering landscape of AI pricing to critical cybersecurity incidents, the ongoing struggles of government IT, and some intriguing developments in both space exploration and the open source software world.
Yeah, it's quite a mix.
You've brought us incredibly rich source material, and we're going to give you a thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive report on each and every key article. We'll be discussing its immediate impact and, of course, its long-term implications. So let's unpack this and uncover what truly matters. Okay, let's kick things off by looking at how AI is fundamentally reshaping the workforce. And it seems not always in ways we might expect. Gartner, the research firm, is sounding a particularly sharp warning about AI's potential to erode human skills. This feels like a bit of a double-edged sword, doesn't it?
It absolutely is, and it's a profound concern. Daryl Plummer, who's a distinguished VP analyst at Gartner, he posed a really provocative question at their symposium conference over in Australia. He asked, and I'm quoting here, "Is there anyone here who's okay with the idea that they may wake up one day and find they have no one left in the organization who knows how to code?" Yeah, he's highlighting a very tangible risk. If developers increasingly rely on AI coding tools to generate code rather than actively writing it themselves, well, they could effectively be losing those critical skills every single day. His conclusion was pretty stark. AI is stealing your skills. That really drives home the urgency.
AI is stealing your skills. It's a bold statement, and it implies this isn't just about coding, right? It's a much broader risk to foundational abilities across different fields.
You've hit on a crucial point. Manjunath Bhatt, another Gartner VP analyst, he actually coined the term skills erosion, and he linked it to something he calls experience compression.
Experience compression.
Yeah, think about it. Employers might, maybe with good intentions, expect AI tools to dramatically fast-track a young developer's skill acquisition, you know, compressing years of learning into just months. But this inadvertently creates what he termed experience starvation. Developers miss out on that vital, hands-on learning, the kind that comes from wrestling with diverse, challenging tasks. And that's really how critical foundational skills are truly built. So it's not just about what AI can do, but the crucial human experiences it might actually prevent, leading to a degradation of core capabilities.
Okay, so if AI is taking over some of these core functions, what's the recommended course of action for organizations? Are they just supposed to let these skills atrophy, sit back and watch?
Not at all. Gartner isn't just, you know, sounding an alarm here. They're offering concrete solutions.
No.
Gartner emphasizes that employers must proactively ensure their developers acquire and consistently exercise core critical thinking and foundational technical skills, specifically focusing on fostering the kind of creativity the machines, well, simply cannot replicate.
Right, the human element.
Exactly. And Plummer adds to this, suggesting that organizations should institute periodic reviews or testing to make sure critical skills are not being eroded by AI. So this means taking a very active, proactive stance against skill degradation, rather than just passively observing it happen.
This has huge implications for anyone in the tech field or even managing a tech team. If you're a developer or you lead developers, what does this mean for your career path or your team's future? How do you maintain your edge and ensure your skills stay sharp when these powerful tools are capable of doing so much for you? It really forces us to confront questions about continuous lifelong learning and adaptation in this rapidly changing environment.
Absolutely. And here's where it gets really interesting. With a surprisingly apt parallel Plummer drew to the early days of social media. He reminded the audience that, initially, we didn't really consider the behavioral byproducts of those addictive algorithms.
We just saw the convenience.
Right. Now, he points out, those effects are horribly obvious. We know it's a pit of doom scrolling in three-second attention spans. The after effects of AI, he cautions, are far harder to predict. Yet, and this is staggering, 91% of CIOs surveyed by Gartner are dedicating little or no time to looking for these potential hidden risks.
91%. That's genuinely chilling. It makes me wonder what unseen, potentially catastrophic issues we're building up for the future by not looking ahead. And if AI is fundamentally changing how we work and even what skills we value, it's only natural that the very tools we use are also adapting to this AI-first world. That leads us neatly to Microsoft's Visual Studio 2026, which seems to be all about deep AI integration.
That's a perfect connection, yeah. Microsoft has just released the first preview of Visual Studio 2026. It marks its first major version update in 5 years, which is quite something. And this isn't just a routine refresh. While it does feature a design overhaul with Fluent Design and some new themes like Mango Paradise and Juicy Plum.
Juicy Plum, okay.
Yeah. But the core focus, the real game changer, is on deeper AI integration. This represents a strategic embedding of AI capabilities directly into the fabric of the developer workflow.
So it's not just a superficial change then, not just a paint job. How will these AI features actually change how developers work day to day? What does it look like?
This is truly about embedding AI into the core processes. For instance, Visual Studio 2026 introduces a profiler copilot agent. This thing can benchmark your code, identify potential optimizations, and even implement those optimizations on your behalf. Imagine the time savings there.
Okay, that's potentially huge.
Right. Another feature is adaptive paste, which automatically adjusts pasted code to fit the existing context, minimizing those frustrating formatting and structural errors we all know. And URL context in Copilot allows developers to reference web documents directly in their chat with Copilot for AI guidance, making it easier to follow best practices or integrate external code snippets.
That sounds useful.
And maybe one of the most significant new features is model choice. This empowers Visual Studio users to select different large language models, whether from Anthropic, Google, or OpenAI. And they can even use their own API keys, giving them unprecedented flexibility and control over the AI models they leverage.
Those sound like genuinely powerful tools. But I'm sure developers also have their own wish lists, right? And sometimes those don't always align with the latest flashy features. What's been the feedback from the developer community on this?
You're absolutely right to ask about that. While the AI integration is certainly a highlight, some developers, particularly in comments on the YouTube presentation, have expressed concerns and priorities that differ slightly from Microsoft's focus. Many prioritize fundamental performance improvements and resource efficiency. Some lamenting that existing solutions often guzzle memory like it's an infinite resource.
I've heard that complaint before.
Yeah, it's a common one. There's also a clear call for more visual designers, which is maybe a surprising gap in an IDE literally called Visual Studio. And there's a long-standing desire for a Linux version, especially considering how widespread VS Code is across platforms.
Still no Linux version for the full VS. Interesting.
Not yet, it seems. Furthermore, the fact that the core Visual Studio process still runs on the legacy .NET framework rather than the latest .NET 10 is a point of contention, particularly for extension publishers who want to leverage the newest language and runtime features.
That certainly provides a more nuanced picture. It's a significant update, clearly, but with some lingering pain points for the community. And for those keeping track of the details, the update actually promises a substantial number of fixes and new features. 4,489 issues fixed and 290 feature requests addressed for VS 2026. That's a lot.
It is a big number.
Plus, code coverage, which was previously an Enterprise Edition exclusive, is now available for community and professional editions, which is a big win for many developers.
Definitely democratizing that feature.
So, for you, the listener, especially if you're a developer, this represents a significant shift. Will these AI features genuinely boost your productivity and allow you to focus on higher-level problems? Or will they simply add another layer of complexity to an already intricate workflow? And how do you ensure your core skills don't erode when a profiler copilot agent can optimize your code for you? These are critical questions for the future of software development. Fascinating stuff. Speaking of core skills and legacy, another foundational Microsoft technology is nearing its end. Tell us about the demise of VBScript and the ongoing challenges of legacy tech.
Yeah, this is a classic example of technical debt finally catching up. Microsoft is actively reminding developers and administrators that VBScript is officially on its way out. This is particularly relevant as Windows 10 approaches its end of life. VBScript has been deprecated for some time now, transitioning to what they call a feature-on-demand, or FOD, status. The projection is that it will be disabled by default in approximately 2026 or 2027, which, you know, in the tech world is basically right around the corner.
So who does this really impact, and what are the implications for those still relying on it? It's been around forever.
It has. This primarily impacts VBA developers who have historically used VBScript for automation and extending office applications. A lot of internal corporate tools still use it. The main challenge lies in future-proofing applications that depend on .vbs files and VBScript-type libraries, like the VBScript, Regex 1 for regular expressions. Many corporate workflows still rely on these older scripts for tasks ranging from report generation to system automation.
Okay, so what's the fix?
Microsoft's proposed solution is an Office update, specifically version 2508, which includes Regex classes directly within VBA itself. This move aims to remove the need for those external VBScript libraries altogether, bringing the functionality in-house, so to speak.
That sounds like a necessary update, but also potentially disruptive for many organizations, especially older ones. What's the practical advice for those dealing with this transition?
The advice from Microsoft is quite clear. Upgrade Office, disable VBScript, and then thoroughly test all your applications. Crucially, test them. While including regex classes directly in VBA is helpful, businesses with thousands, maybe even tens of thousands, of lines of VBScript code deeply embedded in corporate workflows. They'll need to initiate validation and migration exercises sooner rather than later.
Because 2026 or 2027 isn't that far away.
Exactly. That vague timeline for default disabling means that relying on this technology without an active plan could lead to significant loss of functionality and potentially severe business disruption if it's not addressed promptly.
This reminds me of that fantastic anecdote from Raymond Chen, the Microsoft veteran. He recounted what he called the worst Windows bug involving pinball in Windows 95.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah. He discovered the game, because it lacked a frame limiter, would run at like 5,000 frames per second and consume an entire CPU core on faster machines. It even exceeded the three-digit frame rate displays with asterisks.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's a perfect illustration of how seemingly minor overlooked details in legacy features can have significant system impacts and become major headaches down the line, a metaphor for exactly the kind of legacy tech maintenance we're discussing.
That's a perfect analogy. It captures the unexpected complexities of legacy systems and the ripple effects of seemingly small decisions made years, even decades ago. So for you, if you're in IT or manage systems, this VBScript phase-out isn't just a technical detail. It's a critical migration challenge that could seriously disrupt corporate workflows. What hidden VBScript dependencies might you have lurking within your organization, and how quickly can you identify and update them to avoid a potential pinball-level problem? It's definitely a wake-up call for proactive legacy management.
A great question to ponder. But while some technologies are being phased out, Microsoft is also bringing its own employees back to the office in a pretty significant policy shift. This signals a broader trend within the tech industry regarding return-to-office mandates, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Microsoft is implementing a new return-to-office, or RTO, policy. It requires staff to be on premises at least 3 days a week. This policy will be rolled out strategically, starting in Redmond by the end of February 2026.
That soon, okay.
Yeah, then expanding across the U.S. and finally internationally on an unspecified timescale. Amy Coleman, their chief people officer, has clarified that this move is not about reducing headcount, but is explicitly aimed at meeting customers' needs. Employees who wish to seek exemptions must apply by September 19th.
So this isn't just Microsoft being an outlier then. We're seeing a clear industry-wide trend here, a shift back from the pandemic-era policies.
That's right. This isn't an isolated decision at all. It's part of a broader industry shift that started maybe quietly, but is now gaining significant momentum. Amazon, for example, already mandates 5 days in the office. Intel, which is trying to recover from what the Register called decades of failures, is on a 3-day policy with ambitions to increase it to 4.
4 days. Wow.
Yeah. And IBM is taking it even further, reportedly requiring staff relocation to be closer to offices for their 3-day attendance. And we're seeing similar mandates from other tech giants like Dell, Google, and Meta. This signals a pretty decisive move away from the expansive remote work policies that were so prevalent during the height of the pandemic, pushing for a return to more in-person collaboration.
This definitely affects a lot of people in the tech sector and beyond. For you, our listener, it might mean a significant change in your work-life balance, or maybe even a reconsideration of where you live. What are the pros and cons of this shift for overall productivity, for company culture, and critically, for individual flexibility? It's a complex equation without easy answers, and one that is still being debated fiercely in many circles. All right, let's shift gears now from the evolving tech workforce to the, well, the Wild West of AI pricing and the strategic hardware plays that are powering this new era. Our next topic delves into what one analyst has called the pandemonium that currently characterizes AI pricing. Sounds chaotic.
Pandemonium is indeed the word Gartner VP analyst Joe Liversidge used to describe the state of AI software and service licenses at the firm's symposium event. What's truly eye-opening here is that many major vendors, even giants like AWS, are still lacking clear AI-specific language in their main contracts.
Really? It's just missing.
Often, yeah. Yeah, and said this crucial information is buried deep in supplementary terms and conditions, think Clause 50, in AWS's documents, for example. This forces buyers to essentially sift through many vendor policies and legal docs just to understand what they're actually committing to, creating a massive burden of due diligence.
That sounds like an absolute minefield for any organization trying to adopt AI solutions. What are the major risks and implications of this lack of transparency? It feels dangerous.
The lack of clarity creates significant, often hidden risks. A major one is the question of liability. Vendors differ wildly on who is responsible if an AI system provides bad advice that a customer relies on, maybe to their detriment. Liversidge noted that the contracts she's reviewed aren't clear on this.
That's a huge gap.
It is. A prime example is Adobe. They initially demanded customers assume responsibility for copyright infringements caused by its AI software. They only reversed this stance after massive buyer anger. Liversidge stressed that history has shown we have to force the issue, urging buyers to demand responsible AI principles and compliance with ISO 42001. That's a standard for AI management systems in contracts. Shockingly, only about 1% of vendors currently include this, leaving a huge gap in accountability.
So it's not just the terms and conditions, but the pricing models themselves are also a mess. It's confusing on multiple levels.
They're highly inconsistent, yeah, to put it mildly. Salesforce's Agent Source platform, for example, launched with one pricing scheme, then added another, and now apparently offers customers a choice. Many AI vendors are employing credit-based pricing, where users pay upfront for usage rights. But these often come with multipliers that can change unexpectedly, leading to increased usage costs down the line.
Multipliers? How does that work?
It means the cost of a certain action, measured in credits, might suddenly increase based on vendor policy changes or usage tiers, making budgeting very difficult. Another common tactic is token pricing, which often obscures the fact that inputting a token costs far less than the tokens generated in response. So your costs can balloon based on the output length.
Ah, okay.
And these credits can be allocated to individual users or specific products, sometimes making them shelfware by another name if their exact usage isn't fully understood from the outset.
That sounds incredibly complex to manage. Are there at least tools to help track all this? Surely there must be something.
Unfortunately, often no. Liversidge observed the vendors launch products without calculators and without monitoring tools.
Seriously?
Yeah. This makes it incredibly difficult for buyers to track costs and prevent blowouts, especially since existing software monitoring applications often can't handle Gen AI pricing structures. They're just not built for it. Furthermore, some vendors, like Slack, are making it difficult for customers to avoid AI features without incurring extra charges, with a reported 40% cost per seat jump for AI-infused versions of their products. Liversidge has already identified four different charging models just for AI agents alone. It's chaos.
That's a truly tangled web. Liversidge used some vivid metaphors to illustrate this, didn't she? Something about cables.
She did. She described a hopelessly tangled mass of Ethernet cables and a box of old cables with proprietary connectors.
Perfect.
Yeah, it makes a register wonder if the first job facing would-be AI users is therefore to figure out the cost to run an AI that manages the cost of other AIs.
Huh. An AI to manage the AI bills. Maybe that's the next startup idea.
Could be. But for you, especially if you're involved in making AI purchasing decisions for your organization, this is nothing short of a minefield. Transparency is critical, but in a market described as pandemonium, isn't due diligence almost an impossible ask? What's the realistic minimum organization can do when the rules are literally changing by the week?
That's the key question.
The real insight here might be to develop an AI contract playbook. This playbook must mandate explicit liability clauses, require third-party tools to audit token consumption, since vendors often don't provide calculators, and establish quarterly deep dives into supplementary terms and conditions.
Because that's where the gotchas are hidden.
Exactly. Because that's where the hidden multipliers and cost traps will be buried. It's about being proactive and demanding clarity, not just hoping for it.
That's incredibly actionable advice, thank you. From the financial complexities of AI software, let's turn to the hardware battlegrounds where AI is being built. ARM, the chip designer, is making a significant bet on CPU-based AI for mobile devices with its new Lumex chips. What's the story there?
That's right. ARM has unveiled its latest mobile platform, the Lumex Compute Subsystem, or CSS. It features entirely new CPU and GPU designs, all optimized specifically for AI-enabled smartphones. They're claiming some pretty impressive performance gains. An average 15% step up in CPU, 20% in GPU, and a 15% power savings.
Which is key for mobile.
Absolutely. These Lumex chips, crafted for 3-nanometer manufacturing, are expected to appear in devices later this year or early next, with clock speeds running upwards of 4 gigahertz.
Those are some solid numbers. But what's the key focus here regarding AI, and how does ARM plan to achieve these accelerations specifically?
The key focus with Lumex is on ARM's SME2, that stands for Scalable Matrix Extensions. These are specialized instruction sets built directly into the CPU to dramatically accelerate the matrix multiplication operations that are, you know, the computational heart of most AI models.
So baking AI acceleration right into the main processor.
Exactly. Stefan Rosinger, their senior director for CPUs, claims that SME2 provides an order of magnitude better AI acceleration. And critically, using less power and finishing calculations quicker, vital for mobile devices where battery life is king. To give chip designers flexibility, ARM offers 4 core types: C1 Ultra, C1 Premium, C1 Pro, and C1 Nano, along with 3 GPU tiers: Mali, G1 Ultra, Premium, and Pro. The G1 Ultra, for instance, features a redesigned ray tracing unit and supports half precision, or FP16, matrix multiplication for in-game AI, pushing both graphics and AI capabilities forward.
Beyond the cores themselves, are there any system-level optimizations that ARM is introducing to handle the demands of AI? Because it's not just about the processor core, right?
Absolutely. The Lumex platform includes a new system interconnect with a channelized architecture for quality of service, or QoS priority. This ensures critical AI traffic gets through efficiently without getting stuck. There's also a new system memory management unit, or SMMU, optimized to reduce latency by up to 75%. That's crucial for keeping data flowing quickly to and from the AI models.
Keeping the pipes clear.
Precisely. On the software side, ARM's Clyde AI libraries are integrated with major frameworks like PyTorch, Llama, LitterT, and ONNX. This provides essential software support for SME2 acceleration, so developers can easily leverage these new hardware capabilities in their apps.
Now, this brings us to an interesting point of contention in the industry, the NPU debate. ARM seems to be taking a particular stance on where AI processing should happen. It sounds like they're betting on the CPU.
Indeed. ARM's strong belief is that AI processing should be kept on the CPU. They argue it's the only compute unit in the mobile market you can rely on to be present in every mobile phone for a consistent developer experience. Their thinking is, if you start relying on GPUs and NPUs, those are neural processing units, specialized chips just for AI, you end up doing different work for different handsets, leading to fragmentation.
Okay, that makes sense from a developer standpoint.
But this directly contrasts with Gartner's explicit definition of a GenAI smartphone as a device equipped with a built-in neural engine, or NPU. This puts ARM squarely against NPU-centric designs from companies like Qualcomm, which has already demonstrated a 7 billion parameter LLM running directly on Android phones, really showing the power of dedicated AI silicon.
That's a significant difference in philosophy. What do external experts think of ARM's approach? Is it viable?
Well, Bob O'Donnell, president and chief analyst at Technalysis Research, actually supports ARM's approach, given the current market's lack of standardization for NPUs. He points out that developers often default to CPU-GPU processing precisely because of this fragmentation, and ARM's SME2 instructions will help accelerate those functions.
So it's a pragmatic approach?
Yeah. And he also highlights that many of ARM's partners already differentiate with their own NPU designs. So another ARM NPU option could actually worsen the NPU confusion rather than simplifying things. This suggests a practical, market-driven rationale behind ARM's CPU-centric strategy for AI, at least for now.
This is a fascinating architectural debate, and it has real-world consequences for sure. For you, the fundamental question is, will CPU-based AI be the dominant mobile strategy, or will specialized NPUs ultimately prevail? Your next smartphone's AI capabilities are being defined by these bets being placed now. It will be really interesting to see how this plays out in the market over the next few years. Speaking of AI hardware, while ARM focuses on the CPU for mobile AI, NVIDIA is addressing the growing demands for AI inference in data centers with new specialized hardware. Tell us about that.
That's a perfect segue. NVIDIA recently unveiled the Rubin CPX. It's a new GPU specifically designed to accelerate extremely long context AI workflows. Think of things like those sophisticated code assistants, like Microsoft's GitHub Copilot, that need to understand huge amounts of code at once. What's particularly innovative about the Rubin CPX is its aim to achieve this acceleration while simultaneously reducing reliance on that pricey and power-hungry high-bandwidth memory, HBM.
Okay, so this is a very targeted approach to a specific AI challenge handling massive context windows efficiently. How does NVIDIA's strategy of disaggregated inference work to achieve this, and why is it so important now?
NVIDIA's strategy here is quite clever, yeah. It centers on disaggregated inference. This approach breaks down large language model, or LLM, inference into two distinct phases. There's a compute-intensive prefill phase and a memory bandwidth-bound decode phase.
Prefill and decode, got it.
Traditionally, both of these phases would happen on the same GPU. The Rubin CPX, which uses slower, cheaper, but more power-frugal GDDR7 memory, is specifically intended for that prefill stage. The more expensive HBM-equipped GPUs are then reserved for the decode phase, which needs that super-fast memory bandwidth.
So you use the right tool for each part of the job?
Exactly. This disaggregation optimizes both cost and efficiency. And it's becoming critical because, as the article notes, model context windows have leapt from a mere 4,096 tokens to as many as 10 million with Meta's Llama 4 Scout.
Mm.
This huge increase in context means models can handle vastly more information, but it also creates a massive demand for efficient, specialized processing.
Those context windows are indeed growing exponentially. It's hard to even fathom 10 million tokens. What are the specific technical specifications of this Rubin CPX, and how is it integrated into NVIDIA's larger systems?
Okay, so each Rubin CPX accelerator is designed to deliver 30 petaflop PS of NVFP4 compute.
Petaflop PS, that's a lot of FLOPS.
It's incredibly fast processing power, specifically for these specialized AI calculations. Think of FP4 as a highly optimized, compact way to crunch numbers for AI. And the sparsity assumptions mentioned mean they intelligently skip calculations for zero values, saving even more power. It also boasts 128 gigabits of GDDR7 memory. Crucially, it provides a 3x acceleration to attention, which is a key mechanism in LLM inference.
And how do they package these?
When it comes to integration, the NVL144 CPX racks will be quite formidable. They'll feature 36 CPU sockets and a remarkable 288 GPUs. Each compute tray will pack 8 HBM-equipped Rubin GPUs and 8 GDDR7-equipped Rubin CPX GPUs. This hybrid approach allows for that specialized allocation of resources based on the demands of each inference phase.
Beyond disaggregated serving, are there other memory optimization strategies at play here to handle these massive AI workloads? Because memory seems to be a huge bottleneck.
Yes, definitely. Beyond disaggregated serving, prompt caching and KV cache offload are rapidly gaining traction.
KV cache.
Yeah, KV stands for key value, which is essentially how large language models stir the intermediate computations from that prefill phase we talked about. The core idea is to cache these computation outputs from the prefill phase into system memory, rather than recomputing them every single time. This dramatically cuts the time to the first token, making AI responses much faster.
Ah, so you reuse the calculations.
Exactly. And this can be further tiered using things like CXL memory expansion modules, in-memory databases like Redis, or even storage arrays. This allows these key value caches to be saved for future use and retrieved from slower memory or storage without the need for expensive recomputation, even when you hit GPU and system memory limits.
This technical deep dive really shows the cutting edge of AI infrastructure. It's incredibly complex. For you, it means faster, more capable AI applications in the future, especially for complex, long context tasks like coding or detailed analysis, as companies find more efficient and cost-effective ways to power these massive models. Complementing these GPU innovations, other companies are developing specialized CPUs to manage AI workloads, which brings us to Sci5's RISC-V cores for AI acceleration. Another hardware play.
Sci5, the chip designer, is indeed expanding its RISC-V-based core designs specifically for AI accelerators. We're seeing these used in significant projects like Google's Tensor Processing Units, their TPUs, and Tensorn's Black Hole Accelerators. They've just released their second generation of intelligence cores, targeting both low-power edge AI applications and high-end acceleration needs. This signifies a growing push for more specialized, purpose-built silicon in the AI space.
So these aren't general-purpose CPUs, right? What's their specific role in AI acceleration? They're not doing the main number crunching.
That's right. These are not general-purpose CPAs in the way we usually think of them. SiFi's intelligence line cores are primarily designed to function as accelerator control units, or ACUs. Their critical role is to prevent the actual workhorses, the tensor cores and matrix multiply accumulate units, or MXEs, from starving for data. Essentially, they act as efficient data managers and schedulers for the AI processing units.
Got it. They keep the pipeline full.
Precisely. This allows customers to license ready-made ACU designs rather than having to develop custom ones, saving significant time and resources. The new X160 and X180 cores are aimed at low-power edge AI applications like IoT devices, drones, and robotics, supporting 32-bit and 64-bit instruction sets and 128-bit vector registers. The updated X280 and X390 cores, which are used in things like TPUs, support even wider 512-bit and Hanton 24-bit vector registers, respectively, for more demanding workloads.
And what about the technical enhancements in the second generation? Are there specific improvements that make these cores even more effective for AI?
Definitely. The second generation cores feature the RVA23 instruction set, which now includes hardware support for BF16 and OCP's MXFP8 and MXSP4 data types.
More number formats.
Yeah, and the latter are notable because OpenAI's GPT-OS models use them. In simple terms, these are like different resolutions for the numbers AI models use. Lower resolution numbers like FP8 or FP4 use less memory and compute power, allowing for much larger or faster AI models, which is why even cutting-edge models like OpenAI's GPT-OS are now designed to take advantage of them.
Yeah. Efficiency gains.
Big time. SiFi has also optimized the cache hierarchy in the X280 Gen 2, simplifying it for better utilization and die area savings. This is critical for efficiency. The X390 Gen 2 in particular boasts impressive gains, offering 4x the compute and a massive 32x the data throughput compared to the original X280, allowing for up to 1 TB's data movement in its 4-core cluster configuration. That's incredibly fast data shuffling.
They're also talking about take-and-bake accelerators, which sounds intriguing, like ordering pizza.
Sort of. SiFi has also upgraded its XM family of AI accelerator IP. These serve as blueprints for scalable AI accelerators. These now utilize the new X390 Gen 2 cores. These XM clusters can deliver significant 64 teraflop PS of FP8 performance and can be scaled up to over 4 petaflop PS. So they offer powerful, pre-designed solutions for complex AI acceleration needs, much like ordering a custom-tuned engine for your AI projects ready to integrate.
This indicates a growing specialization in chip design to meet the diverse demands of AI, from the smallest edge devices to the largest data centers. For you, it means more efficient AI at the edge in devices like your smart home gadgets or drones, and more powerful, custom-tailored AI infrastructure in the cloud, ultimately leading to more capable and responsive AI across the board. Now, these hardware advancements are driving massive investments, particularly from cloud giants, in the AI space. This brings us to the AI gold rush currently underway among the major cloud providers. The numbers are wild.
This is truly a gold rush scenario, yeah. But with some fascinating undercurrents and maybe some caution needed, Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian recently reported an astounding $106 billion in unfulfilled contracts.
Billion with a B.
With a B. And over 50% of that is expected to convert to revenue within 2 years, adding an extra $53 billion by 2027. He directly attributes this massive growth to AI, stating that customer focus has dramatically shifted to vendors who can provide AI transformation solutions. Similarly, Microsoft has just inked a near $20 billion deal with Nebius, that company co-founded by an ex-Yandex executive, purely for AI infrastructure.
$20 billion just for infrastructure.
Right. Microsoft has even joined the World Nuclear Association, explicitly linking nuclear power to the future energy demands of data centers. That tells you the scale they're thinking at. And then there's Oracle, boasting an incredible $455 billion backlog from the AI boom.
$455 billion, that's astronomical.
It's a figure so large, it's positioning Larry Ellison to potentially become the world's richest person again.
Wow. Let's dig into Google's strategy first. How exactly are they differentiating themselves and monetizing AI in this crowded field?
Kurian really emphasized Google's deep 11-year history in AI systems and chips. He's claiming their systems offer 2x power efficiency, a 50% performance delta, and 118x more throughput compared to competitors. Big claims.
Bold claims.
Very. He proudly states that Google is the only hyperscaler offering both its own systems and its own models, processing twice the token volume in half the time. Google's monetization strategy for AI is multifaceted. Customers pay for token consumption, sure, but also subscriptions to services like Agent Space and Workspace. and there's increased usage of existing products. For example, a cybersecurity agent powered by AI drives more usage of their security platform.
So AI makes other products stickier.
Exactly. They also employ value-based pricing, where customers pay based on metrics like deflection rates for customer service or ad conversion for creative tools. And of course, the classic upsells to pricier tiers.
Yeah.
Impressively, 65% of Google Cloud customers are already using AI tools meaningfully. And these customers, on average, use 1.5 times more products overall.
That's a significant multiplier.
It is. AI is being deployed to build digital products like the Warner Bros. Sphere in Vegas for customer service, to streamline back office functions like Home Depot's HR, and for IT applications such as code writing and cyber threat scanning. It's really permeating everything.
And what about Microsoft's investment strategy in this space? That $20 billion Nebius deal is certainly significant, especially given some mixed results from early Copilot trials.
Microsoft's nearly $20 billion deal with Nebius is a clear reflection of its continued aggressive investment in AI infrastructure. Full steam ahead. This comes despite, as you mentioned, a UK government trial of M365 Copilot finding no clear productivity gain, which raises questions about immediate ROI versus long-term strategic positioning.
They're playing the long game.
Seems like it. CEO Satya Nadella had previously committed an eye-watering $80 billion for 2025 infrastructure. While there were initial reports of data center lease cancellations, he clarified these were merely adjusting its portfolio for future workload growth, suggesting they're continuously optimizing their vast global footprint, not scaling back.
And Oracle, with that colossal backlog, seems to be a major beneficiary of this AI boom. Is it all smooth sailing for them?
Larry Ellison certainly thinks so. He stated that AI is fundamentally transforming Oracle and the rest of the computer industry. He notes their cloud infrastructure business grew by 55% over the last year, with major AI companies like OpenAI, xAI, Meta, NVIDIA, and AMD counted among their clients. Ellison predicts that AI inference, the act of applying trained models to new data, will become a much larger market than AI training itself. He sees inference as the long-term play for profitability.
Even all this investment and rapid growth, it sounds like a highly competitive market, but I've also heard talk of a potential extinction event for some of these players. Is that really on the horizon, a shakeout?
That's a crucial point of caution in this AI gold rush. Gartner's John David Lovelock warns of an extinction coming for AI model providers. He predicts that the market will ultimately only support three significant players, much like the cloud market has consolidated around AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud.
Only three.
That's his prediction. He foresees a gradual pruning rather than a sudden dot-com-style bubble burst where smaller, less differentiated players simply fade away. It's important to note that Oracle, despite its impressive backlog, is not considered one of the three established cloud giants in Lovelock's analysis.
Interesting. So where is Oracle's growth coming from then?
Well, DA Davidson analyst Gil Luria suggests that many of Oracle's reported AI infrastructure customers are actually the other hyperscalers like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, who are offloading their capacity onto Oracle temporarily.
So Oracle is acting as overflow capacity for the big guys?
Potentially, yes. This raises questions about the long-term sustainability of Oracle's AI boom. As these hyperscalers eventually build out their own sufficient capacity, they might reduce their reliance on Oracle, impacting that huge backlog.
These massive investments and shifting market dynamics mean that the AI landscape is intensely competitive and, yeah, maybe somewhat volatile. While innovation is incredibly rapid, the long-term winners and losers are far from decided. For you, it's a powerful reminder that beneath all the excitement and hype, there's a complex and often cutthroat economic battle for dominance playing out. Understanding these underlying currents is key to navigating the future of AI. Okay, let's shift gears again to a critical area that touches every digital interaction: cybersecurity challenges. We're going from leaky phone calls to global ransomware, highlighting just how vulnerable our connected world can be. First up is the alarming story of Heligem's leaky audio database.
That sounds bad.
This is really a stark reminder of how basic security failures can have massive implications. An exclusive report revealed that Heligem, a service provider for major gyms like Anytime Fitness and Snap Fitness, left sensitive information from hundreds of thousands of gym customers and staff exposed in an unencrypted, non-password-protected AWS database. Just sitting there.
Unencrypted and no password. Seriously. Security researcher Jeremiah Fowler discovered a staggering 1.6 million audio files collected between 2020 and 2025. These contain names, phone numbers, reasons for calls, and some even discuss payment details. This wasn't just PII. It was highly sensitive personal interactions left wide open for anyone to find.
That's incredibly concerning. What are the specific risks and implications of such a massive data exposure, especially with audio files? That feels different.
The exposed data carried severe risks. Criminals could have easily performed adversary-in-the-middle attacks, you know, impersonating staff to steal credit card details or phony cancellation fees. But even more alarmingly, with advanced AI tools like Microsoft's Vela E, capable of cloning a human voice from just 3 seconds of audio.
3 seconds?
Yeah. These voice recordings become a form of biometric data. This could enable sophisticated identity theft and the creation of deepfake audio or video for highly convincing social engineering scams. For instance, impersonating an executive to request fraudulent money transfers. We're seeing this happen already.
Wow. The voice itself is the vulnerability.
Exactly. And what's more, recordings even captured gym employees exposing personal passwords to corporate headquarters in the calls, creating another layer of vulnerability for the organization itself, just basic operational security failures.
So it's not just the data, but the very sound of our voices that becomes a potential attack vector. What are the key recommendations for organizations to prevent such incidents? This feels like basic hygiene.
Fowler's advice is unequivocal, and yeah, it is pretty basic stuff. Organizations must use encryption, perform regular penetration testing to identify misconfigured systems like this one, and implement robust policies for segmenting and deleting old data. He specifically notes, and I quote, "Far too often I see organizations storing years' worth of records in a single database and not deleting old files." Okay. This highlights a widespread problem of data hoarding that significantly increases the attack surface and exposure in the event of a breach. It creates a much larger, juicier target for attackers.
This is a crucial takeaway for you listening. If you're out there using services like this, this is a stark reminder to be incredibly cautious about what personal and financial information you share over the phone. Assume it might not be secure. It also underscores the absolute importance of strong data security practices by any service provider you use. Your voice itself, as we've discussed, is now a potential attack vector. This highlights vulnerabilities in third-party services, a theme that echoes in another major recent cyber incident, the SalesLoft Drift breach.
Indeed, and that brings us to the massive SalesLoft Drift breach. This incident compromised hundreds of companies, including major players like Google, Palo Alto Networks, and Cloudflare. Huge names. The investigation traced the origin of the attack back to miscreants gaining unauthorized access to a SalesLoft GitHub account back in March. Once inside, the attackers downloaded content, added a guest user, and established malicious workflows. This initial compromise then became the springboard for something much larger, a classic supply chain attack pattern.
That initial access point is always critical. What happened next, and what were the broader implications for the affected companies once they got into SalesLoft?
Following the initial breach of the SalesLoft GitHub account, the attackers then leveraged their access to compromise Drift's AWS environment. So they pivoted. From there, they managed to steal OAuth tokens, which are essentially digital keys or permissions for Drift customers' technology integrations.
Ah, the OAuth tokens. Always a target.
Always. These stolen OAuth tokens were then used to break into numerous Salesforce instances, hundreds of them, according to Cloudflare, and exfiltrate sensitive customer data. This attack has been attributed to sophisticated threat groups such as UNC6395, GRUB1, and Shiny Hunters. SalesLoft acted by hiring Mandiant, the incident response firm, which confirmed the incident was contained after taking Drift offline, rotating credentials, and isolating the affected infrastructure. But the damage was done.
This really drives home the interconnectedness of our digital ecosystems. One breach ripples outwards. What key lessons can we learn from this, especially regarding third-party access and those OAuth tokens?
This breach serves as a prime example of crucial cybersecurity lessons, as highlighted by Bill McCluggage in a feature from The Register. The big lesson here, OAuth tokens. You need to treat them like the keys to the kingdom, lock them down, change them often, and watch them like a hawk for suspicious activity. Scope them tightly.
Least privilege for tokens.
Absolutely. Businesses absolutely need to have a clear understanding of what apps have access to their data and why that access is necessary. Regular audits are key. If you use third-party tools, especially those that integrate deeply with your core systems like Salesforce, you are only as secure as your weakest link. The compromise of even one vendor can have a devastating domino effect across many organizations, directly impacting your data. It's a critical reminder that trust in your supply chain is not a given. It must be continuously verified.
Speaking of widespread impact, another high-profile company recently suffered a significant cyber attack, Jaguar Land Rover. Sounds like that caused chaos.
JLR confirmed that some data was affected in a cyber attack that hit them early last week. Initially, this caused severe disruption and forced their systems offline globally. The attack stalled production and dealer operations, even leading to the closure of their Saula Hole plant and preventing new vehicle registrations or parts supply. A major hit.
Wow, grinding operations to a halt.
Yeah. The group's scattered Lapsus hunters claimed responsibility, and they're reportedly collaborating with Shiny Hunters and Lapsus, the same groups implicated in the recent Marks and Spencer breach. These groups are very active.
That sounds like a company brought to its knees, at least temporarily. How did JLR respond, and what can other organizations learn from their actions in that moment of crisis?
JLR's response, particularly their swift decision to shut down their IT systems across their distributed operations, was seen by experts as bold and necessary to prevent attackers from moving laterally and causing even wider damage. Containment was key. This highlights the critical importance of having pre-authorized response plans, agreed upon at the board level, and regularly rehearsed, so that such decisive action can be taken without hesitation, even when it means immediate business disruption.
You need that authority beforehand.
You do. The incident severely disrupted services. Customers couldn't even get their cars serviced due to issues with parts ordering and diagnostics. It's a stark example of how a cyber attack can cripple an entire business operation and the importance of a rapid, pre-planned response.
Bill McCluggage from The Register offered some broader security lessons from this incident as well, which I think are really vital. What were they?
McCluggage outlined three crucial lessons. First, act quickly. JLR's speed in isolating its systems likely limited the damage significantly. He notes that hesitation, often driven by fear of business disruption, can be catastrophic. Organizations must pre-authorize who can pull the plug, essentially, who can isolate systems and revoke access without needing a full committee meeting in the middle of the night.
Speed is everything.
It really is. Second, understand access. As we saw with the Salesloft Drift incident, attackers often bypass users by exploiting trusted app access. This means OED tokens need tight scoping, frequent rotation, and continuous monitoring for suspicious activity. Finally, adopt a zero trust model. The core idea here is that no user, device, or system is trusted by default. Access is granted only after identity, posture, and context are verified for each request.
Trust nothing, verify everything.
Exactly. While this is a significant undertaking for businesses with legacy systems, it is increasingly seen as necessary to protect against modern, sophisticated threats.
This is a real-world example of how a cyber attack can cripple operations and how crucial a rapid, decisive response is. For you, it underscores the importance of having maybe even personal incident response plans for your digital life and understanding the security posture of the companies you rely on. It's no longer just about protecting your passwords. It's about understanding the entire ecosystem of digital trust and risk. While JLR dealt with external threats, other security news highlights vulnerabilities across the software supply chain and even within government. We've got a quick rundown of some other critical cybersecurity flashpoints from the week. What else is going on?
Absolutely. It's been a busy week for security news. First, we saw more NPM packages poisoned in another supply chain attack. While the would-be crypto thieves apparently gained very little financially, researchers described the true impact as a denial-of-service attack on the industry. It wastes countless hours in mitigation efforts, with compromised code found in at least 10% of cloud environments, a real persistent headache for developers and IT security teams.
Just constant vigilance required.
Constantly. On the consumer front, streaming platform Plex announced its third password breach in a decade. Third! Ouch! Yeah, not a great record. Emails, usernames, and supposedly securely hashed passwords were potentially stolen. The 2015 breach was particularly concerning due to a weak hashing implementation they used back then. Plex is recommending immediate password resets, enabling two-factor authentication, 2FA, if you haven't already, and logging out of connected devices. Standard breach procedure, but the recurrence is worrying.
And what about government security? There was a rather shocking report about the Pentagon exposing keys.
Yeah, and a significant security lapse. The U.S. Department of Defense routinely left its social media accounts vulnerable to hijacking by exposing stream keys for years. These are unique, confidential identifiers needed for broadcasting content, and they were publicly available on its Defense Visual Information Distribution Service, or DVI's, website.
Publicly available stream keys for DoD accounts.
For years, apparently. This potentially allowed attackers to broadcast anything they wished from official Pentagon channels. The practice has since been fixed, thankfully. But it adds to a growing list of Pentagon security snafus, including using China-based employees for Microsoft Azure DoD cloud services, which has since ended, and the controversial Signalgate incident.
So while they're having some internal issues fixing their own security, the Pentagon is also trying to tighten things up for its contractors, right, with the CMMC program.
Correct. The Pentagon has finalized its Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, or CMMC, program, effective November 9, 2025. This new rule requires defense industrial-based contractors, anyone doing business with the DoD, to meet one of three CMMC compliance levels. These range from self-assessment for lower-risk contracts to government-led audits for higher-risk ones, depending on the sensitivity of the data they handle. The goal is clear. Ensure that vendors prioritize U.S. national security in their cybersecurity practices, pushing for a baseline of security across a vast and critical supply chain.
Trying to raise the bar for everyone in the chain makes sense. And in enterprise software, SAP had a particularly bad Patch Tuesday this time.
Indeed. This Patch Tuesday, SAP was identified by some as the worst offender, patching a critical flaw in its widely used NetWeaver platform. This flaw could potentially allow total takeover of affected systems. In comparison, Microsoft's patches, while numerous as always, were generally less severe this month. It underscores that critical vulnerabilities aren't limited to specific vendors or platforms. Even foundational enterprise systems require constant vigilance and prompt patching.
And finally, there's been a major development in the fight against ransomware, right? An indictment.
Yes, a potentially significant win for law enforcement globally. A Ukrainian national, Volodymyr Tymoshchuk, 28, has been indicted by the U.S. for allegedly orchestrating the LockerNoga, MegaCortex, and Nephilim ransomware operations. These operations caused an estimated $18 billion in damages across hundreds of organizations worldwide, including the very high-profile attack on Norsk Hydro a few years back.
$18 billion. That's incredible damage.
It's a staggering figure. Prosecutors claim he targeted over 250 U.S. companies alone. And crucially, U.S. authorities apparently managed to preempt many extortion attempts by notifying victims before the ransomware could be fully deployed, based on intelligence they gathered. This is a significant step in bringing major cybercriminals to justice and hopefully disrupting their profit motives, showing that international cooperation can yield results.
These stories collectively paint a vivid picture of an increasingly complex and dangerous threat landscape. Vulnerabilities can be found in the most unexpected places, from insecure public databases storing voice recordings to mismanaged credentials like OAuth tokens and relentless ransomware gangs. For you, the message is crystal clear. Vigilance, strong authentication like 2FA, and a deep understanding of potential risks in every digital interaction are absolutely paramount in today's connected world. You just can't be too careful. All right, let's pivot now to the challenges faced by government IT and the public sector, which, as our sources often show, are frequently plagued by legacy systems and, frankly, bureaucratic woes. We'll start with the UK Home Office, a department that seems to be in perpetual IT chaos and is now on the hunt for a new leader. What's the situation?
The UK Home Office has, a rather notorious track record for failing IT projects.
Yeah.
It's become almost legendary. They're currently seeking a Chief Digital and Innovation Officer, or CDIO. It's a role with a hefty salary of £160,000, which is almost equivalent to the Prime Minister's salary.
For an IT leadership role.
Okay. Yeah. This individual will be tasked with leading a team of 4,000 people and overseeing a massive $1.8 billion budget. The goal: to transform services that touch millions of lives every single day. The scale of the challenge is immense, almost Herculean, given the history.
Transform services that touch millions of lives sounds like a monumental task, especially given that history. What are some of the specific concrete challenges that this new CDIO will face beyond just the budget and team size?
The challenges are indeed immense and multifaceted, representing decades of accumulated technical debt and project mismanagement. The border control and immigration project, for instance, is plagued by persistent delays and massive uncertainty about its future. The emergency service network, meant for police, fire, and ambulance services, has already cost taxpayers £2 billion, with essentially nothing functional to show for it. It's now scheduled to go live around 2029, a staggering 12 years later than originally planned.
12 years late and £2 billion over. Wow.
Yeah. Furthermore, a 25-year-old asylum claims database is proving virtually impossible to decommission, highlighting the deep-seated legacy tech issues that just won't die. The new CDIO will need to drive modernization, including moving services to the cloud, despite previous very public criticism over escalating contract costs. For example, a $450 million cloud contract, replacing one signed for just $120 million only 3 years prior.
How do costs escalate that quickly?
Well, the chief commercial officer, Andrew Forzani, cited very dominant suppliers and limited choice as reasons for these high costs, pointing to a distinct lack of market competition in the government IT space, which exacerbates the problem. The job description itself, requiring strong corporate and political acumen and outstanding communication and influencing skills, implicitly acknowledges the need to navigate intense public scrutiny and political headwinds. It's as much a political job as a technical one.
This really highlights the profound difficulties large government departments face in digital transformation, often hampered by legacy systems, budget constraints, political interference, and a lack of market competition. For you, it means that vital public services, which you and I rely on every day, might be less efficient or reliable due to these underlying tech issues, often locked into legacy systems with limited options for improvement. Beyond these broader IT issues, the Home Office is also wrestling with specific technological applications, especially controversial ones like using AI for age determination. That sounds problematic.
This is another contentious and ethically fraught area for the Home Office, yeah.
Well,
they're currently offering about $1.7 million for an algorithm that can accurately predict the age of a subject.
Yes.
The primary stated use is for those who are encountered without verifiable identity documentation at the border, mainly asylum seekers. Work on this algorithm is set to begin on January 19, 2026, with an expected completion 3 years later.
That sounds like a very sensitive application of AI, especially considering the context of border control and asylum claims. What are the deeper implications and concerns surrounding this initiative, particularly given past issues the Home Office has had with this?
This tender follows what reports called alarming safeguarding failure, where hundreds of children seeking asylum were wrongly classified as adults by existing, less sophisticated methods, leading to their potential exposure to abuse in adult facilities. The Refugee Council, in a report earlier this year, strongly criticized such scientific measures for age assessment as ineffective, expensive, and harmful. They cited the profound negative impact on the mental health for those being assessed and highlighted that the National Age Assessment Board, or NAAB, already costs $1.7 million annually without providing consistently reliable results.
So the current methods aren't great either?
No. The Independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration also found that current methods cannot be relied upon. This casts a long shadow over the efficacy and ethics of this new algorithm, especially regarding its accuracy, potential for bias against certain demographics, and the real-world consequences of getting it wrong.
There's also a political context to this, isn't there, with the government trying to be seen to be using tech to tighten border controls?
Yes, indeed. The Labor government had previously announced a trial of AI tech for border age assessments, claiming it would produce an age estimate within a known degree of accuracy, but notably without specifying what that accuracy level actually was. Vagueness is often a red flag here.
Definitely.
Furthermore, while immigration is the stated primary use, the Home Office oversees a wide range of areas, including crime, policing, drugs policy, and counterterrorism. This raises critical questions about the potential for broader and perhaps less transparent applications of such an age determination algorithm in other contexts. The Register reached out to the Home Office for clarification on this expanded scope, but received no response, leaving the potential for function creep a very open question.
This raises critical ethical questions about how AI is deployed in sensitive public services, particularly when human rights and safeguarding are at stake. For you, it's a crucial reminder to question the accuracy, the potential biases, and the broader implications of AI systems, especially when they are making decisions that can profoundly affect individuals' lives and well-being. Just because it's AI doesn't mean it's right or fair. The challenges facing the Home Office are not unique within UK public services, as you mentioned. Let's look at the National Crime Agency.
That's absolutely correct. Moving from the Home Office's struggles, we find similar issues plaguing the UK National Crime Agency, or NCA. His Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services, HMICFRS, found that the NCA, which is tasked with targeting serious and organized crime, clings to legacy systems and has an IT strategy that lacks clarity. Sound familiar?
Depressingly familiar. What's the result?
The result is significant technical debt and a critical inability to transfer data between computer systems operating on different government security tiers, a major hindrance to sharing intelligence and coordinating operations effectively.
That sounds like a serious operational problem for an agency fighting serious crime. How has this impacted the NCA's effectiveness on the ground?
The report highlights that the NCA has made only limited progress in moving off legacy systems since its inception back in 2013. It inherited much of its outdated infrastructure from predecessors like the Serious Organized Crime Agency. This has led to poor connectivity, scant mobile computing capabilities for officers in the field, and fragile critical applications that are prone to failure. All of this significantly hinders the agency's efficiency and effectiveness in tackling complex criminal networks.
Is there a plan to fix it?
They've embarked on a 10-year IT strategy, with the first phase costing $250 million. However, the second phase, estimated at a massive $350 to $500 million, is entirely dependent on securing additional Home Office funding.
Which, given the Home Office's own IT budget black hole.
Exactly. It's far from guaranteed.
So not only are the systems outdated, but there are also critical data gaps affecting their operations, according to the report.
Precisely. The inspectors found that data sets related to serious organized crime were actually missing from the National Data Exploitation Capability Data Catalog, a central repository. Furthermore, there are currently no plans to integrate or use data from the Law Enforcement Data Service, or LEDS, which is set to replace the aging police national computer in 2026. This means critical intelligence might be siloed or entirely unutilized, creating dangerous blind spots in the fight against serious crime. Information just isn't flowing.
What's the recommendation?
HMICFRS has advised the NCA, working with the Home Office, to establish a clear timeline, an indicative budget, and a priority order for modernizing its IT by September 30th. So get a real plan in place. NCA Director General Graham Bigger acknowledged the report, stating that their national data exploitation capability achieved most objectives and that extensive action is underway for technology modernization, but the inspectorate clearly feels progress has been far too slow.
This directly impacts national security and public safety. For you, it means that the fight against serious crime in the UK may be significantly hampered by outdated technology and inefficient data sharing, potentially making the country less secure and its law enforcement less effective than it could be. Beyond national crime, even local public services in the UK are facing tech-related disruptions, as seen with the UK school's Broadcom Azure uptime fiasco. What happened there?
This is a localized but very impactful failure that directly affects children's safety and education on a daily basis. Broadcom, a UK school management information system, or MIS, provider, had a really bad start to the academic year due to significant problems with its Azure-based service. This left school staff unable to track student attendance or even access crucial parent contact details. Imagine that in an emergency.
That's critical functionality.
Absolutely. Their own status page showed severe degradation, despite them claiming 99% uptime over the preceding 90 days, a period that conveniently included the long summer school holidays when usage was minimal.
Ugh, the classic uptime statistic manipulation. What was the real impact on schools when students actually returned and needed the system?
The reality was quite severe. A server fault on September 4th apparently led to 5 full days of instability, with the system being reported as very slow or totally down by frustrated users. This directly impacted critical school operations. Staff were struggling to check which students were actually in the building, complete mandatory fire registers, or even get crucial parental contact details in an emergency.
Basic safety procedures were compromised.
Exactly. Tasks that should have taken minutes were stretching into hours due to constant refreshing and system unresponsiveness. It's a clear example of how IT failure in public services has immediate, tangible consequences for daily life and safety right down to the local school level.
And is there any regulatory oversight for these critical school systems? That seems like a major vulnerability if a provider can just fall over like this.
Surprisingly, no. The UK Department for Education states that schools are ultimately responsible for choosing and managing their own IT systems, and it has no specific regulatory guidance or requirements for MIS providers like Broadcom. The DfE even notes that many suppliers will not guarantee that their systems will function and be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So basically, schools are on their own.
Pretty much. This lack of oversight leaves schools vulnerable and without clear recourse when critical systems fail, essentially leaving them to fend for themselves in a complex IT landscape with potentially unreliable suppliers.
For you, this story underscores how deeply reliant our public services, even local ones like schools, are on IT infrastructure, and the potentially severe consequences when that infrastructure fails, especially without strong regulatory oversight or guarantees. It's a reminder that even seemingly small tech failures can have profound human impacts, from disrupting education to compromising children's safety. From IT failures, let's consider new regulations impacting online content and privacy across the UK. The Online Safety Act is being toughened up.
Yes. A planned amendment to the UK's controversial Online Safety Act will make tech companies legally required to proactively prevent content involving self-harm from appearing on their platforms. This is a shift from just removing it after it's been reported. Self-harm content will become a priority offense, necessitating these proactive technical measures.
Proactive prevention, not just takedown. That's a significant change in responsibility for platforms. What's the rationale?
Science and Technology Minister Liz Kendall stated, "This is to protect users from vile content that can have heart-wrenching consequences, particularly for vulnerable individuals." While platforms already have duties to protect children, this amendment expands that proactive duty to protect all users from self-harm content, requiring platforms to actively seek out and eliminate such content using technology like content moderation algorithms. The Samaritan's Charity supports the move, emphasizing its potential to save lives.
But the Online Safety Act itself has been pretty controversial from the start, hasn't it? Concerns about privacy and censorship?
It has been highly controversial, yes. Private messaging platform Signal, for instance, previously warned the act threatened to undermine the privacy promises and the encryption on which it relies, because proactive scanning is hard to reconcile with end-to-end encryption.
The encryption dilemma.
Exactly. Experts and civil liberties groups fear it grants the government overly broad censorship powers and is being applied too broadly, potentially impacting niche online communities, like a cycling forum mentioned in the article, and even personal blogs that simply allow user comments. They worry about the chilling effect on free expression.
This is a classic balancing act, isn't it? Protecting vulnerable individuals versus preserving freedom of speech and privacy online. For you, it means that while your online experience might be curated more heavily to remove harmful content like self-harm material, it also raises legitimate questions about censorship, platform responsibility, the feasibility of policing content at scale, and the potential impact on the integrity of encrypted communications. It's a complex trade-off with no easy answers. While the UK grapples with content moderation and public sector IT, the US government is facing its own bureaucratic challenges, particularly with its cybersecurity workforce and the regulation of AI. First, the workforce data crisis.
Yeah, transitioning to the US, a recent Government Accountability Office, or GAO, report found something quite alarming. The U.S. federal government, which theoretically employs tens of thousands of cybersecurity professionals at a cost of billions per year, actually has incomplete and unreliable data on its own workforce. They don't know who they employ, essentially.
They don't know who works for them in cyber. How bad is it?
Pretty bad. Out of 23 agencies reviewed, most had only partial or no data on contractors doing cybersecurity work, which is a huge part of the workforce. And a staggering 19 agencies lacked any quality assurance processes for the data they did have. To make matters worse, 17 agencies didn't even have standardized practices to define who qualifies as a cybersecurity employee in the first place. It's creating a chaotic system where no one really knows the true capabilities or headcount across the federal government.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster, frankly. What are the direct implications of such a significant data crisis for national security if you don't know who your defenders are?
This mess, according to the GAO, is a recipe for more preventable cybersecurity incidents. Why? Because of potential understaffing in critical areas, or conversely, hiring unqualified personnel for highly sensitive roles because there's no clear standard or tracking. The Office of the National Cyber Director, or ONCD, which is supposed to coordinate national cybersecurity policy and strategy, is criticized for not issuing proper guidance to fix this. And its working group responsible for implementing improvements has apparently been suspended.
It's suspended. Why?
The report doesn't say exactly why, but the future of this working group is uncertain, especially with Trump's newly confirmed National Cyber Director, Sean Cairncross, being a lawyer with no prior cybersecurity leadership role. It raises questions about the priority this will receive.
It sounds like a political blame game is also at play here, muddying the waters even further and preventing progress.
Indeed. The ONCD apparently attempted to blame the previous Biden administration for the data issues, although the GAO report covered investigations up to September 2025, and specifically noted Biden-era initiatives aimed at improving data quality initiatives that are now effectively in limbo. The GAO made four key recommendations. Address the data gaps, ensure data quality, standardize role identification, and actually assess workforce effectiveness.
And the ONCD's response?
Their official response was that they did not agree or disagree with the recommendations, which is hardly a commitment to decisive action.
Did not agree to disagree. That's something. This is deeply concerning for national security. For you, it means that the federal government's ability to effectively defend against sophisticated cyber threats may be severely compromised by a fundamental lack of understanding of its own capabilities and personnel. A pretty basic failure. Adding to this bureaucratic maze are the myriad of regulations attempting to govern AI, creating another layer of complexity and potential paralysis. Too many cooks.
This is another significant friction point, yes. The U.S. government's strong push for AI adoption across all its agencies, which is happening rapidly, is running into what the report calls a growing mass of AI rules. We're talking about nearly 100 different requirements laid down by 10 separate oversight and advisory groups.
10 different groups issuing rules.
Yeah. This creates a bureaucratic, immovable object that directly confronts the unstoppable force of new technological advancements. It's a classic case of too many cooks in the regulatory kitchen, leading to confusion, overlapping requirements, and potential inefficiency. It could actually stifle the very innovation they aim to adopt responsibly.
So while the administration wants rapid AI adoption, the regulatory environment itself is creating a significant hurdle. It sounds counterproductive.
Precisely. AI is a clear priority for the current Trump administration. Generative AI use cases in government reportedly surged ninefold between 2023 and 2024 alone. Deals under Trump's OneGov contracting strategy offer leading AI models for as little as $1 per agency for the first year, showing a clear intent to accelerate adoption across the board. However, as GAO's Kevin Walsh emphasizes, while AI holds substantial promise, it also poses risks, such as enabling sophisticated cyber attacks, fraud, and the de-anonymization of supposedly private data. The challenge is ensuring responsible use, and right now, the regulatory landscape feels more like a confusing patchwork than a coherent strategy.
And how well are agencies complying with the existing rules, scattered and complex as they might be? Are they even managing that?
Apparently not well. The GAO has been issuing recommendations for federal AI oversight for 4 years now, but agencies have largely failed to act on them effectively. And the ONCD's noncommittal stance of did not agree or disagree with the GAO's recommendations for improving AI rules suggests a continued lack of clear direction and accountability in this critical area. It leaves a lot of uncertainty about how these powerful technologies will actually be governed in practice.
This situation suggests a chaotic and potentially ineffective approach to governing powerful AI technologies within the U.S. government. For you, it means that while the benefits of AI in government services might be delayed or undermined by regulatory red tape and confusion, the inherent risks that AI presents might not be adequately mitigated either. It's a complex balance, and right now, the scales seem to be tipped towards paralysis and confusion. Okay, to wrap up our deep dive today, let's explore some other interesting tech and space highlights from the feed. First, a classic moment that provides a window into the intensity and sometimes the frustration of open source development. Linus Torvalds' rant on pointless link tags. Always entertaining.
Ah, yes. A perennial favorite from the creator of Linux. Linus Torvalds recently vented his frustration, quite publicly, on the Linux kernel mailing list. He was complaining about what he calls pointless link arguments in commit messages the NOS developers write explaining their code changes. He urged developers, in his typical blunt style, to stop this garbage already, stating flatly that 99% of these links are stupid, useless garbage that only waste my time.
Huh. Classic Linus. He certainly doesn't pull any punches, does he? What's the core of his complaint, and why does it matter in a project as massive and critical as the Linux kernel?
Torvalds insists that links included in commit messages must provide additional information or genuinely useful explanations for a commit. They shouldn't just repeat existing messages or point to unhelpful, already seen email threads. He actually said he'd be a lot less annoyed by a link that led to a meaningful discussion thread rather than just a perfunctory email confirmation.
So context matters.
Deeply. This highlights the absolute importance of clear, concise communication and valuable context in highly technical, collaborative projects like kernel development. In such a massive project, where literally thousands of developers contribute from all over the world, efficiency and clarity in communication are paramount to maintaining progress and preventing wasted effort. It's really about respecting the time of everyone involved, especially the lead maintainer who has to review everything.
Despite his grumpiness, though, the work on Linux continues, doesn't it? It always seems to power through.
Absolutely. Despite his frank criticisms, and he readily admits, yes, I'm grumpy. I feel like my main job is to try to make sense of pull requests. Linux 6.17 RC5 was released shortly after. It promises improvements like better memory management, improved Rust toolchain support, which is a big ongoing effort, and broader hardware coverage for new AMD and Intel silicon. So even amidst the strong opinions and occasional friction, the development engine keeps humming along, demonstrating the robust and resilient nature of the open source community.
This isn't just a technical rant from a famous developer. It's a window into the passion and the rigorous standards that drive foundational software development, the stuff underpinning so much of our digital world. For you, it's a powerful reminder that even in highly structured, collaborative environments, communication clarity and efficiency remain absolutely critical. They directly influence the quality and pace of innovation. While Torvalds keeps the Linux kernel tidy, the broader open source OS world is seeing a real flurry of new releases and developments. It feels like a busy time.
It's definitely a busy season for FOS, or free and open source software, showcasing incredible vibrancy and innovation across the ecosystem. We're seeing exciting updates across the board. First, Pop.OS 24.04, which comes from System 76, is entering beta on September 25th. The big news there is its brand new REST-based Cosmic desktop environment.
Cosmic, tell me more. What's the goal there?
Cosmic aims for a modern, minimal, sort of genome-like desktop aesthetic, but with significantly more options and customizability. Early reports describe it as very snappy and responsive, offering more freedom to rearrange things in Genome itself, and featuring integrated tile and window management, which is popular with developers. While it's apparently still a little unpolished visually in the beta, it could provide serious competition to the established Genome desktop environment in the Linux world.
Interesting. And for the more traditional Unix users, what's new with FreeBSD? That's a different beast entirely.
FreeBSD 15 has reached its alpha stage, with the full release expected in late November. FreeBSD always has a dedicated following. This release brings several significant enhancements, including enhanced ZFS integration. ZFS being a powerful file system that's a major draw for many FreeBSD users. It now automatically creates encrypted ZFS datasets for new user home directories, which is a nice security boost.
That's useful.
It also expands dtrace output formats, providing more powerful debugging and system analysis capabilities. Dtrace is another key FreeBSD feature. Other improvements include better power management, more flexible boot up and shutdown controls, and enhanced ARM64 bootloader handling, reflecting the growing importance of ARM-based systems in the server and embedded space where FreeBSD often plays.
And Project Banana sounds quite unique. What's the story behind KDE Linux, and how does it differentiate itself from, say, KDE Neon?
KDE Linux, yes, charmingly codenamed Project Banana, is a significant departure from the older KDE Neon distribution. It takes a bold, innovative approach, building on a cutting-edge, non-commercial basis of Arch Linux, which is known for being very up-to-date.
Built on Arch. Okay, that's different.
What's particularly noteworthy is its robust architecture. It features dual failover root partitions with BTRS snapshots and rollback. This allows for enhanced stability and resilience. If an update breaks something, you can easily roll back. And it's immutable, meaning its core system files are read-only, preventing accidental damage. It exclusively uses cross-platform Flatpak apps through KDE's Discover Store for applications.
So immutable core, Flatpaks for apps, and rollback. Sounds very modern.
Very. This approach combines existing technologies into what the Register calls a potentially more robust rival to Windows or macOS, offering transactional updates and easy rollback for enhanced stability and user peace of mind. It's an exciting development in desktop Linux.
These developments really showcase the vibrancy and innovation happening within the open source community. For you, it means more choice and increasingly powerful, stable, and user-friendly operating systems are emerging, potentially offering compelling alternatives to commercial options for both personal and professional use. Lots to explore there. From software innovation, let's pivot briefly back to hardware and some significant shifts in the world of chip manufacturing and executive leadership at a major player.
Right. Intel, a long-standing titan in the chip industry, is currently undergoing its latest executive shakeup under CEO Lip-Bu-Tan. They seem to be constantly reorganizing lately. Most notably, Michelle Johnston Holthaus, who served as CEO of products for just 10 months, a very short tenure, and was a 30-year veteran of the company, is departing.
10 months, that's fast.
Very fast. And her role will apparently not be backfilled, signaling a significant structural change within the company, perhaps consolidating power or streamlining decision-making.
What are the implications of this, and who are the new faces coming in? It seems like Intel is really trying to reorient itself again.
This reorganization comes as Intel continues its struggle to regain its competitive edge against rivals like AMD and the growing number of ARM-based CPU vendors, especially after having to outsource some of its own advanced production to TSMC. New hires include Kevork Kechikian, formerly of ARM, which is interesting, as the new head of the data center group. And Jim Johnson takes over the client computing group. Both bring significant engineering experience.
Bringing in outside engineering talent
seems to be the focus. Furthermore, Srinivasan Iyengar will lead a newly formed central engineering group, specifically tasked with building a custom silicon business for external customers. This indicates a serious push into the foundry business and offering design services, trying to compete directly with TSMC and Samsung, not just on manufacturing, but design too. Naga Chandrasekaran's role as EVP and COO of the foundry division is also being expanded to create a more integrated structure between design and manufacturing.
These moves reflect Intel's aggressive, ongoing efforts to adapt and compete in a rapidly evolving semiconductor landscape. They're trying to bring manufacturing prowess and design expertise back together and maybe become more agile. For you, these internal shifts at a tech giant like Intel can significantly influence the performance, features, and even the very architecture of the devices and data centers you interact with daily. The chips in your next laptop or the servers running your cloud services could be directly affected by these leadership changes. Let's look up. Way up to the stars for what could be a truly monumental potential discovery. NASA's hinting at life on Mars.
This is truly astounding news, yeah, and perhaps the most profound story in our deep dive today. NASA has just announced peer-reviewed evidence hinting at ancient extraterrestrial microbial life on Mars. The Perseverance rover collected a sample dubbed Sapphire Canyon back in July 2024. It came from the Retva Valles, a region near the Jezero crater, which scientists are quite confident was an ancient lakebed billions of years ago. Prime real estate for finding signs of past life.
Best evidence of life on Mars so far. That's a huge claim from NASA. What exactly makes this evidence so compelling this time, and why are scientists so excited? Is this truly it, the smoking gun?
Well, U.S. Transportation Secretary and acting NASA Administrator Sean Duffy stated that after a full year of rigorous peer review, the scientific community can't find another explanation for the specific chemical and mineralogical findings in the sample. That's significant.
No other explanation.
But Nicola Fox, who's the NASA Science Mission Director and Associate Administrator, she provided crucial clarification. She said, it's the closest we've come, but stressed it's a signature, a leftover sign, not life itself. She likened it beautifully to seeing leftover fossils from a meal excreted by a microbe an astonishing 3.5 billion years ago. Evidence of biological processes, not the microbes themselves.
Okay, so what is the evidence? What did they find in Sapphire Canyon?
Lead author Joel Hurwitz detailed observations of tiny structures described as poppy seeds and leopard spots on the rock. These contain G-band signals in spectroscopy, which are indicative of organic carbon. Crucially, the mudstone itself is rich in iron phosphate, likely the mineral vivianite, and iron sulfide, specifically greigite. Both of these minerals commonly form on Earth in the presence of organic material and microbial activity.
But can they form without life?
That's the key question. While these minerals can theoretically form abiotically, without life, the scientists found no evidence of the high heat that would typically be required for abiotic greigite formation under Martian conditions. This makes a biological origin a strong and as yet unchallenged explanation for what Perseverance observed.
That's incredibly compelling, but it sounds like direct human analysis back here on Earth is still needed for absolute confirmation. What's the status of the Mars sample return mission that would bring these precious samples back? That feels absolutely critical now.
You're right. Confirmation requires lab analysis here. Project scientist Katie Stack Morgan stressed that humans need to analyze these samples directly, as the rover has reached the limits of its in-situ analysis capabilities. However, the Mars Sample Return, or MSR, mission, specifically designed for this exact purpose, has been, frankly, struggling for years with being over budget, too technologically complex, and much delayed. It's faced huge hurdles.
So it's in trouble.
It's currently at serious risk of being cut from next year's U.S. budget. Duffy, the acting administrator, wants MSR to continue efficiently. But the Trump administration's broader space priority is stated as human exploration, potentially overshadowing robotic missions like MSR, despite this discovery.
And meanwhile, China is moving ahead.
That's the kicker. In a worrying development for U.S. leadership in this area, China has actually moved its own Mars sample return mission up to 2028, aiming to return rocks by 2031. This means they could potentially win this new space race for Martian samples, and the profound scientific prestige, maybe even a Nobel Prize, that comes with confirming extraterrestrial life.
This is a truly profound potential discovery, with implications that could reshape our understanding of life in the universe and our place within it. For you, it represents a moment of genuine scientific excitement. But it also starkly highlights the very real political and financial challenges of ambitious long-term space missions and the potential for new space races to unfold as nations vie for scientific and technological leadership, even as we reach for the stars. From exploring potential life on Mars, let's look at how another major player in space, SpaceX, is expanding its reach much closer to home, right here on Earth. A massive spectrum purchase.
That's a perfect transition back to Earth, yeah. SpaceX has just made a massive strategic move by acquiring EchoStar's AWS-4 and H-Block Spectrum licenses. The price tag, a whopping $17 billion. This deal is split between $8.5 billion in cash and $8.5 billion in SpaceX stock, which also tells you something about how EchoStar values SpaceX equity.
$17 billion for Spectrum, that's enormous.
It grants SpaceX 50 megahertz of exclusive S-band spectrum in the U.S., along with global mobile satellite service licenses. This is a game changer for their Starlink ambitions, particularly for providing service directly to standard cell phones.
So this is all about Starlink direct-to-cell. What's the ultimate goal here, and how will this acquisition impact Starlink's capabilities, particularly for the average cell phone user on the ground?
This deal is absolutely crucial for SpaceX to develop and deploy its next-generation Starlink direct-to-cell constellation. The mission, as they state it, is clear: to provide broadband service to cell phones globally, essentially aiming to eliminate mobile dead zones entirely.
No more dead zones anywhere. That's the dream.
That's the ambitious goal. SpaceX already has over 600 first-generation direct-to-cell satellites in orbit, doing initial testing with partners like T-Mobile. With this new spectrum, they anticipate the next-generation satellites will offer 20 times the throughput of a first-generation satellite and a 100-fold capacity increase. Huge leaps in capability. SpaceX President Gwynne Shotwell states this advances their mission to end mobile dead zones around the world and gives them much more flexibility in its operations. The deal also means EchoStar's Boost mobile subscribers in the U.S. will eventually gain access to this expanded satellite-based service. And it conveniently addresses FCC concerns about EchoStar sitting on valuable unused spectrum for years, putting that airwave real estate to use.
And what's the broader market impact of a deal this size beyond just SpaceX? What happens to EchoStar now?
Well, this acquisition signifies the definitive end of EchoStar's own independent satellite constellation plans. In a rather abrupt move, they terminated a $1.3 billion contract with MDA Space for 100 satellites almost immediately after the SpaceX deal was announced.
So they're out of the satellite game themselves.
It seems so. This reshapes the competitive landscape for satellite broadband, and particularly for direct-to-device services. It could accelerate the timeline for truly ubiquitous global connectivity, potentially putting more pressure on traditional cellular providers as well.
This is a major step towards truly global mobile connectivity, eliminating those frustrating dead zones we all encounter, whether hiking, driving in rural areas, or during emergencies. For you, it means reliable cell service could soon be available almost anywhere on Earth, fundamentally changing how we communicate, work, travel, and connect, especially in remote areas or during natural disasters when terrestrial networks go down. Imagine the implications.
Wow. What an incredible journey through today's tech landscapes that was, from the very fabric of our digital skills potentially being reshaped, even eroded, by AI, to the mind-boggling financial and engineering battles playing out in AI infrastructure. And the constant evolving fight against increasingly sophisticated cyber threats, it's clear we're living in a period of unprecedented technological change and challenge.
And then, layered on top of all that, there's the tantalizing potential for discovering life beyond Earth. And a new space race heating up for global connectivity right here. It's dizzying.
Absolutely, Sam. And what truly stands out when you look at all these stories together is the deep interconnectedness. You can't really separate them. The relentless drive for AI advancements fuels these massive hardware investments we discussed, but it also simultaneously creates new complex cybersecurity vulnerabilities and really tricky regulatory challenges for government.
Right, everything's linked.
Meanwhile, human skills are being fundamentally reshaped. And our public services, as we saw, are often struggling to keep pace, hampered by legacy systems, budget fights, and bureaucratic inertia. It's this constant push and pull between innovation and its consequences, demanding adaptability at every single level, from the individual developer right up to global institutions.
It certainly is. And for you, our listener, we hope this deep dive has not only informed you about these specific developments, but also maybe sparked some new questions and connections in your own mind. So here's a provocative thought to leave you with today, building on that Gartner warning we started with. If AI is indeed potentially stealing our skills and fundamentally reshaping the global workforce, and simultaneously creating this market pandemonium of hidden costs, confusing terms, and shifting liabilities, are we, as individuals, as companies, as societies, adequately preparing ourselves and our institutions for a future where the very tools designed to help us could also fundamentally alter what it means to be skilled, what value we bring, and at what ultimate price?
Yeah, and how much responsibility are we willing to take for the future we're actively building right now before it's maybe too late to clearly see and manage the full behavioral byproducts, as Gardner put it? Are we looking for those unintended consequences?
A question worth pondering. This has been The Deep Dive. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to exploring more fascinating topics with you next time.